Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site. You can find all of our episodes over on iTunes. You can also subscribe to our show there as well, and all of our shows will end up right on your iPhone. And we are continuing our Iditarod coverage. Today is our fifth day, and I am welcomed by my co-host. He's calling in from Southern California, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
Robert, it's going great here. It's a lovely day in Southern California. I'm actually speaking to you right from the beach, from the edge of the continental United States on the Santa Monica Pier today.
Oh, wow. And guess who is joining me right outside of my window? A huge moose is looking right at me through the window while she eats on our trees, probably 10 feet from the house.
And you know, that's I wish that there were more moose down here. We're sadly moose-deprived locally, but it's always amazing to see moose when you're in Alaska, and particularly if you have, you know, some nice protective windows or a wall between the two of you.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I thought it was interesting when you said you were at the beach and here I am with a moose outside. What a difference of environment for the two hosts here, one in Alaska and one in California.
Yeah, and you know, it's the miracle of modern technology that we can do this and bring these shows to everyone. And, you know, I know that you're going to be off for a few days doing this expedition, but as always, it is just a joy to do these shows with you.
It is. I am so happy that we're back again this year. Like I said, we're on our fifth day of coverage. I guess it's considered the fourth day on Iditarod since they had to take a break to get up to Fairbanks, and things are happening on the trail. We have a good majority of the mushers at the halfway point in Huslia, which is about 470 odd miles along the trail, and things are looking nicely. We've only had one scratch. Is that right?
Right, and you know, this is the point in the race where the mandatory rests really come into play. So we're seeing there are, last I checked, I think 11 or 12 mushers in Huslia. There are a lot of mushers in Galena, and a lot of mushers on the trail between the two places. Martin Boozer, who was leading the race early on, is fairly far back now, but he is one of the few teams that has taken both his mandatory 24 and his mandatory 8-hour rest on the Yukon. So although he's about, I think at this point, about 40 miles outside of Huslia, he has an advantage because he has taken those rests that other mushers are now just starting to have to take. So Mitch Seavey, who has been out in front and was the first racer to get to the halfway point, hasn't taken either his 8-hour or his 24. I believe he's in the middle of his 24 now. So he is not going to be able to move until sometime tonight. And then he still has to take an 8-hour rest sometime further on down the Yukon. So although he was fairly far ahead, now a lot of other teams that have taken their rests are going to be able to catch up. So I was looking at the standings, and I know that Dallas Seavey, for example, has taken his 24 and is starting to catch up to his dad, Mitch, but he hasn't taken his 8 either. So it's always a question of where you're going to take your mandatory rests and trying to strategize so that you can, you know, take the rest at a point where it will where your dogs will really benefit from that extra period of rest and where you can really, in a sense, I think someone described it as rebooting the team for the second half of the race.
Right, and it's very important on when you decide. There was an article, I believe, I read this morning that says if you rest too early, it's detrimental to the dogs, and of course, if you rest too late, it can be very detrimental to the dogs. You want to have that perfect balance, and that's what figuring out that race schedule for Iditarod and most other races is all about. But you know what's interesting, Alex, is when all of these 24s and 8-hour rests are done, no matter where a person has taken them on the trail, you can figure out relatively quickly after everything's said and done who's in the lead, but they may be further back on the trail. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, longtime listeners already know this, but just for people who might be newer to Iditarod, when the teams start in Fairbanks, they start every 2 minutes. So the Iditarod isn't like some sled dog races where you have a mass start and everyone goes at the same time. You're starting at different times, and the way they even that out is when you take your 24 hours, there's a time added onto it, unless you're the last team that starts. There's time added onto it to make sure that everyone has the same elapsed time after they've taken their 24s. So if you're the second to last team, you would have a 24-hour rest of 24 hours and 2 minutes to make up for those 2 minutes at the start. And then the first team is, I guess, 24 hours plus, I'm not good at math, but 70 times 2. So, you know, that's 140, so that's an extra 2 hours and 20 minutes that you have to rest. So this is all figured in so that by the time you come off of your 24, you're even as far as the differential for the start goes. And then if you look on the standings on Iditarod.com, they have columns, checkmark columns for the 8-hour rest and the 24-hour rest. So you can see who has taken what. When we were on the air yesterday, there weren't any teams that had completed their 24s, and today there's a handful of them that have and are back on the race, on the trail.
Right.
You know, I read an article about Allie Zirkel, who took her 24 in Galena. She was planning on going all the way up to Huslia, which is where a lot of people are going to be taking their 24s, but her team had some sort of bug, some sort of virus, and she took an early rest because they weren't doing as well as she wanted them to do, in hopes that, you know, having 24 hours where they could just sit and not have to be running would help them all feel better and get better, just like you or I might, you know, call in sick to work when you had a bug.
Right, and it's a little easier for us because we can lounge around on the lazy boy, but the dogs, they seem to bounce back relatively quickly, and, you know, you hear that a lot on the Iditarod that dog teams have bugs, and that's very common. Vaccinations are required for the dogs, but when you have 1,000 dogs along a trail and all of those dogs are camped out relatively close to each other, and of course, all of the bugs that are in the villages with the village dogs and whatnot, it's just like having your kids in a kindergarten class. They're going to pick up bugs and bring them home, and mom and dad will get them. It is very similar to sled dogs. Often it's not very a very big deal. Maybe a little diarrhea, maybe a little bit of upset stomach, but they seem to bounce back relatively quickly.
Right, absolutely. And the comparison to a kindergarten class is really a great one, and I've heard a lot of people in the past couple of days talk about that. And when you consider that in a kindergarten class, you have a lot of kids who are in very close quarters, they're touching things, they're sometimes eating some of the same food. So it's a similar sort of thing where you have a lot of dogs who might be eating the same food. If there's any contamination in the food or if the food is exposed to a bug, then that could spread that way. But even when, you know, even when the the dogs are in separate areas in a checkpoint, they are relatively close to each other. So viruses can pass back and forth pretty easily.
Right. And speaking of problems on the trail with dogs, we did have a dog death today, and that's very unfortunate. It really shakes things up on the race, not only for the musher that has that dog, but you know, it always is a big story, isn't it?
It really is, and it's always a very sad thing when this happens. We had a string of a few years with no dog deaths at all. When I first started following Iditarod in the early 2000s, it was not that unusual for there to be five or six dog deaths in each race, which does seem like a lot. But when you consider that you're talking about, 1,000, sometimes 1,200, 1,300 dogs over a two-week, sometimes more than two-week period, it's not really all that much. But there have been a number of improvements in both the veterinary care, vets knowing warning signs to look for that were causing a lot of dog distress and dog deaths. So we have gotten it down to the point in the past few years where usually there will only be one or two, and on good years, none at all.
Right. And, you know, it's a very interesting topic because you'll often hear folks say, oh my goodness, dogs are dying on the Iditarod, we need to ban the race, and you know, all of that sort of stuff. You know, I've been mushing for 23 years, Alex, and I have been very fortunate enough that I've never had a dog die on me on the line. And it just by my standards, it's a relatively rare occurrence. And I bet if you were to poll a good majority of the mushers out on Iditarod, they would say that either they've only had one or two in all of the years that they've been doing it, or maybe not at all. But guys and gals have to think that it's not that uncommon for major health problems to happen in large endurance sporting events for people as well. When you think about Ironman triathlons and the Boston Marathon and some of these ultra marathons where they're running, you know, hundreds of miles over trails, all sorts of these things have problems just like Iditarod. But there's often a case where people that watch the Iditarod or pay attention to Iditarod take what they see with their pet dog and do a transference between what's sitting on their couch and what's out there on the trail. And it's an entirely different species. And a lot of times, Alex, these dogs are dying not from overexertion, not from abuse, not from anything human error, but often it's a genetic thing, most often it's a heart thing that just isn't caught in time, and unfortunately the dog perishes on the trail.
Right, and when this happens, it is a devastating event for the mushers. We've seen since I've been following the race closely, there have been a couple of races where mushers have been in the lead and have been doing really well and on their way to winning the race and had a dog die, and it just is so devastating that they, in some cases, have scratched from the race altogether, and in other cases have not been able to be as competitive and have, you know, gone from expecting to win the race to coming in, you know, 20th or 25th. So this is also something that I think the community of people who love dog racing and the sport, as well as people who are recreational mushers and people who are you know, just interested in training with dogs, this is something that hits them fairly deeply. I did want to mention that the dog that died was on Seth Barnes' team. It was a yearling named Deacon, and we don't have a cause of death. They'll fly the dog to Fairbanks, I believe, to do a necropsy. I can never pronounce that name, that word. And we'll know more later. But apparently the dog collapsed a few miles outside of, I believe it was Galena. And then Seth put the dog in the sled bag and brought the dog in. And when he got into the checkpoint, the vets immediately tried to revive this dog and give him mouth to snout, and worked on him, but were unable to do so.
Right. Well, we will definitely find out, and if it is, and almost always, I would say 99% of the time, it is not the case where it is a musher error of some point. Some type of sanctions would come down if that is, in fact, the case. But that is rare, isn't it? I haven't heard in years where a musher was sanctioned for one of the dogs that had perished on the trail. Have you?
No, I haven't. And, you know, I think a lot of times people who are against Iditarod and who like to point out dog suffering and like to point out every time a dog dies, there's a lot of information that gets regurgitated, which is in many cases very, very old information. There's the standards of dog care and the best practices have really changed enormously in the past 30 years. And I wasn't around, so I can't make any claims or judgments about it, but I'm sure that there are things that mushers may have done in the early days of the race in the 1970s that no one would think of doing now. Just like in the same way that there are things that people do, that people did in the 1960s and 70s that they thought were okay things to do in terms of raising their children or just, you know, the different ways you would talk about certain groups of people that you would never do now. So it's important also when you're looking at some of this information to look at really where it comes from and how old it is. And there's a lot of very, very old information that gets regurgitated every time a dog dies. And I'm not trying to make light of this or make it less than it is, because it is always a very, very sad event when a dog dies.
Yeah, I agree with you for sure. So we will definitely keep everybody updated on what happens here, and hopefully throughout the rest of the race, nothing like this happens again. But let's switch gears a little bit, Alex. We have about 12 minutes left on our show. I know you wanted to mention a quick story about what some folks are bringing along the trail. There's quite a few stories about this. I was reading the article as you were talking just a few minutes ago about things that people carry down the trail. A lot of times it's memorials, books, all sorts of stuff. What do you have for us?
Yeah, well, Hugh Neff, our buddy Hugh Neff, who is well known for always starting with the Cat in the Hat, every year he carries a book to give to the library in Nome. And this year, I believe he's carrying a book of children's letters to Pope Francis. So every year he has a different book that he brings with him down the Iditarod Trail and presents to the public library in Nome. And there are several other mushers who have other things that they're bringing. There are a couple of mushers who are bringing ashes that they're going to scatter on the trail, both dog ashes and human ashes. It wasn't in this particular article, but I think I read a couple of weeks ago that someone had given Cindy Abbott some ashes that they wanted brought along the trail for I believe an Iditarod fan. So she has some ashes in her sled. Larry Daughtry has the prayer flags. He is, we've talked to him on a previous episode of Mushing Radio. He's an Anchorage-based oncologist, and he has prayer flags for his patients I believe it may be his patients who didn't make it so that he could remember them when he was on the Iditarod Trail. And he also, I just read, is planning on summiting Mount Everest later this year. So he's also going to be bringing those flags with him up on Mount Everest.
Yeah, you know, it's a moving tribute to carry things along for people, you know, and a lot of times as you mentioned, it's fans of the race. It could be previous Iditarod mushers that have passed on. You know, it's just one of those very touching memorials that people do. And, you know, we talked about the Iditariders at the beginning of our coverage this year, and so many mushers will share that ride with kids or adults that are part of Make-A-Wish Foundation and that sort of thing, you know, very ill children and adults that, you know, that is their one wish that they hope to fulfill, and they do that as well. There's just a lot of good out there, isn't there, Alex?
Yeah, there really is. And, you know, almost every musher that I've spoken to talks about how there are moments on the trail where they are just overwhelmed by the natural beauty and by the fact that they get to be out among this type of amazing scenery. And for a lot of people, it is a very moving thing to be out in nature, and it is for some of them a very spiritual and very calming and sometimes a very religious experience for them. And to be able to take something as sacred as someone's ashes and share that with the environment is really just a beautiful thing.
It is, for sure. So let's jump on over to our musher profile of this evening. We're going to talk about Canadian musher Michelle Phillips. Is that right?
That's right. And Michelle Phillips is a very interesting musher. She is someone who I think is really on the verge of becoming just an absolute top contender. This is her eighth race. She has four top 20 finishes. Her best finish was 16th in 2012. She's from Whitehorse in the Yukon and runs Tagish Lake Kennels with her partner, Ed Hopkins, who has also run, I believe, Iditarod and definitely the Yukon Quest. And he got his start as a handler working for Susan Butcher. So this is a very well-connected and very, very cool kennel that they have. Michelle was, when she was growing up, she was a competitive figure skater, and she did that and traveled all over the world competing in figure skating until she was about 16. And then she decided that wasn't something that she wanted to continue pouring her heart and soul into. She wasn't exactly sure what she wanted to do. So after she stopped skating, she went around the world in various places, volunteering and helping people in mining camps and in food kitchens and things like that, in places like India, Thailand, Ecuador, Peru, Chile, Belize. She moved back to Whitehorse. She wasn't quite sure what she wanted to do, and she met Ed Hopkins, helped him run dogs for many years. They got married, had a son, and she decided that when her son got to be 4 years old that she was going to start trying to mush and run races as well. She ran her first Yukon Quest in 2004, and she said that she felt like at various places on the trail she felt like she was going to die. A musher named Frank Turner had lost his dog team on Eagle Summit, and she wiped out and got her foot caught between sleds and dislocated her shoulder and was able to get everything straightened out and get back on the trail. And in the end, she came in ninth, and she thought, oh, that was okay, but I know that I could do better. So she kept racing in races like the Yukon Quest. She says that she likes quiet, peace, and the wilderness. These days, she tends to run the Yukon Quest 300, which is the smaller race, every other year. She runs it when it starts out of Whitehorse, which is about 90 miles from where she's living now. She's won the Yukon Quest 300 three times now, once beat out, including this year, and once beat out Ali Zirkel by exactly 8 seconds at the end of a 300-mile race, which is pretty cool. And she said that at one point she was thinking about either getting a job or giving up mushing, because she realized that, as we've talked about a lot on this show, mushing is a very, very expensive thing to do. And to do it competitively and to do it well just takes a lot of time and a lot of money. So she was thinking about either giving it up or getting a job so that she could better pay for this. And she was out in the middle of a training run, and she said that it was so gorgeous that she thought to herself, I have the sun and the wilderness and a dog team, so who cares if I have a job? Which is just a wonderful, wonderful sentiment. Michelle is a very interesting musher, because she is, if you talk to her one-on-one, she is very friendly and she's very knowledgeable and she's willing to talk to people. She often, I think, has she comes across as someone who's a little bit busy, and I think she's less, I don't want to say less friendly, but she's a little bit less approachable than some of the other female mushers who are just incredibly magnanimous and go out of their way, like Ali Zirkel. She's much more the type of musher who is focused on the task and just, getting it done. And if you can interrupt her, she's perfectly willing to talk to you, but you might not feel like that's okay to do because she is often so focused. And she also is, we talked quite a lot last year and earlier this year about the documentary Sled Dogs, and she was one of the Canadian mushers who was very active in approaching the Canadian government about withdrawing support for that movie, and was very outspoken about how it misrepresented what competitive mushing and what mushing kennels are like.
For sure. You know, Alex, you talked about Michelle having to go out and get a job and how expensive mushing can be. I'm looking at her career summary here on Iditarod.com. She started, as you mentioned, in 2010. She's ran 7 races up to that point. Her lowest finish was 27th in 2010, and her highest finish was in 2012 at 16th. But it appears that every year she's right there in that top 20. So what that means is she's in the money every year. And I don't know how often you look at this summary, Alex, but in 7 years, she has only earned $67,475. And just a little bit of a perspective, we have a kennel of 40 sled dogs here, and we're not Iditarod mushers, but we do quite a bit of traveling and a little bit of racing. It costs us about $50,000 a year just to keep track of our kennel here. So she's only made just a little bit more than that in 7 years. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's it's not that sounds about right to me. And it's the sort of thing where people do this because they love it. They don't do it to make a living. I was struck a few years back that Lance Mackey said there's only one or two mushers every year who can make a living out of dog racing. So everybody else is doing other things. They're doing, sled dog tours on the glacier in the summer, or they have actual office jobs, or they're commercial fishermen or things like that. But it is very, very unusual for anyone to be able to support themselves just on dog racing. And, you know, as someone like Lance Mackey, who's a great, great dog man and a great champion, showed, even if you're one of those one or two people, if you do it for a couple of years, you could fall out and not do as well, and then you wouldn't be able to make your living just from mushing. So, you know, this is something that is very, very expensive to do. And the people who do it, I just have so much admiration for them, because it's clear that they're doing it because it's something they really love.
Right. That is words of the truth, for sure. We just love what we do. So, Alex, we are 4 days, 5 hours, 30 minutes into the race. A good portion of the pack is at the halfway point. So it looks like we're right on pace for that 8 or 9 day finish that we've seen in the past. It should be a little faster this year than the last couple of years, because it's an entirely different trail. They're not having to go over that mountain range there at the beginning. So I would say about mid-time next week sometime, we will have a winner. And I don't know who it will be. I don't know if it'll be my buddy Nick Pettit or Dallas Seavey or Ali Zirkel or any number of folks. It could even be Wade Mars or even Jason Mackey, who are really just burning it up the trail there. Who are we talking about tomorrow before we close for the evening?
You know, I left my notes at home, so I don't actually have that information, but I will get that by tomorrow morning. Do we have like another minute, or are we out of time?
Go for it, for sure. And I want to do a programming update as well, because we're going to do a different time tomorrow than we typically do. So, yeah, what else is on your mind?
So this is a question that I have for you as a musher. I was looking at Nick Pettit, who was the first to the Yukon and won the first to the Yukon prize, which is the multi-course meal we talked about. Usually when someone will win that prize, they will then stay at that checkpoint for their 8-hour Yukon River rest. But I noticed that when
right.
Nick won that, he stayed for about 6.5 hours and then left, and then took his 8, I believe, at the following checkpoint, or maybe the checkpoint after. So I'm wondering, does this seem to you like a tactical error, because he could have stayed an additional 90 minutes and then just gotten his 8-hour rest out of the way and wouldn't have to worry about it?
You know, that's a great question, Alex. And, of course, I don't know exactly what Nick's doing on the trail, but most of the time they are on a very specific run-rest schedule that has been decided on well in advance. So no matter if they win the award or not, they already know how far they're going to go down the trail and how long they're going to rest and where they're going to rest along the way. A lot of times, I know we've talked about it on this show, a lot of times you will have mushers that go into a checkpoint, sign in, sign out, maybe spend a few minutes, and then buzz on out, and then you will see them stopped on the tracker, maybe only 5 miles outside of the checkpoint. And they're doing that because they want their dogs to rest in relative silence compared to the hubbub of a very busy checkpoint, as Galena was when he won that award there a few days ago. So I would bet that it's right on his run-rest schedule, and I doubt very seriously he thought that he was going to win that award when he made that schedule back in October or September or whenever he did it. But then again, there's no reason to deviate from that schedule if you don't have to. No matter if you got $3,500 fresh dollars in your pocket or not, you don't want to give up something just because of something else. The one thing that people always say is you train for the race and you race how you train. And that's a very important thing in long-distance mushing. And I would bet that's what he's doing out there on the trail this time.
That's excellent. Really, really great information. Thank you so much.
No problem. You bet. Anything else before we close?
That's about it. Just wanted to have a very, very quick shout out to our friend Cindy Godby in Skagway, who's been a little bit under the weather, Dawson Dolly. So just wanted to let you know, Cindy, that we're thinking about you, and hope you're feeling better, and talk to you soon.
Excellent. Hey, give us a shout out of your Twitter handle. I know you've been active. I see you pop up all hours of the night on my Twitter feed.
Yeah, I am at Coldfoot Films, one word, and I believe you are tweeting these days mostly at Robert Forto.
That's it. All right, Alex, enjoy the pier. I hope to visit that when we're down there this summer and check out some of the local sights and sounds of Southern California. Looking forward to having dinner with you when I'm down there.
Excellent. That sounds wonderful. And we will talk to you guys, and you will hear us again tomorrow. And by then, we should have a lot of teams back out on the trail.
Yes, 11 a.m. Alaska time tomorrow. That will be 2 p.m. Eastern time, so a little earlier because I'm hitting the trail. So we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.